House Bill 2192A. Richard, if you could please give us a summary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2192A directs school district boards to adopt policies for the discipline, suspension, or expulsion of students. It outlines the conduct that may result in discipline, suspension, or expulsion. It declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, we have a panel. Mark McKechnie, Martha Brooks, and Marion Kakarnis, you want to all come up together? If that works. Welcome. Thanks for being here today. And I understand you're going to be testifying on 2192A with the -2 amendments. No.
Chair has
just on the underlying.
On 2192A.
Okay. I understand.
No new amendments.
Oh, new amendments. Okay. -2s are from the House. -2s.
Yes, there are -2.
There were -2s.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are -2 amendments that the Office of Legislative Counsel has asked us to include.
I'm sorry.
There are conflict amendments. They're -A2s. They resolve a potential conflict with a bill that passed out of this committee and was enacted earlier this year, House Bill 2756A. So they're,
just
conflict amendments. Yeah.
Technical
amendments.
Okay. Didn't mean to confuse you there. Go ahead.
All right, thank you. Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. We are a nonprofit law firm representing children and youth in Multnomah County. We've represented 50,000 children, youth, and parents in the juvenile court system since 1975. And for the past 15 years, we've also represented some of those students in school matters. This bill is intended, 2192, is intended to modernize the statutes that guide districts' school discipline policies based on emerging research that punitive discipline, particularly zero tolerance policies, often do more harm than good. And rather than fulfilling the intent of those policies to keep schools safer, they often fail to keep schools safer and often make the climate in a school worse, where you find lower academic achievement, higher student stress, more conflict between students and staff. This bill, as it comes to you in the Angros form, represents a consensus that was reached on the House side among the various groups representing education interests, students, and families. The primary substantive change that this bill makes to the statute is removing the additional zero tolerance requirements that were enacted in Oregon about 20 years ago. It certainly leaves the compliance with federal law in place, but it removes the requirement that schools would automatically expel students for infractions that involve a weapon or more often what the school perceives to be a weapon. Items that actually don't meet the statutory definition of a weapon have been used as the rationale to expel students for the maximum of 1 year. So we're taking that out of the statute. And there's a lot of support from districts and administrators for that change because they have felt that their hands are often tied and they're forced to make decisions that they wouldn't otherwise make when they take into account the student's age, developmental level, their history of behavior and academics, and possibly disability status. Other than that, what the bill really encourages is more discretion at the building level, more inclusion of students in classroom or alternative activities to make sure that even students who are struggling behaviorally don't fall even further behind academically when the school responds to their behavior. We know that many, if not most, students who act out in school have an underlying academic problem, and removing them from the school environment for even a day, but often for 5 or 10 days or longer under an expulsion, only exacerbates the underlying problem. I didn't give you all the data that I could have, but I'll point you to a few charts that are attached to my written testimony. I assume all of you have this. You can see that there's been a pretty significant growth on this first chart in terms of suspensions per 1,000 students in Oregon. There was a spike in 2008 that seems to be somewhat of an anomaly, but overall there's been about an increase of a third in suspensions across the state from 2005 to 2012, and the evidence, the data on the effect of suspension really does not support the idea that that's a good trend, and we're hoping to start to see a reversal in that trend. One of the clearest indications of why suspension can be counterproductive is on the next page. There's an inverse relationship between the number of times a student has been suspended and the likelihood that they'll graduate from high school. Multiple studies in different states have found that in the ninth grade, which is considered a critical transition year, even one suspension can dramatically decrease the chances of graduation. And in studies, the dropout rate roughly doubles for students who've been suspended just one time, and then it gets worse with each successive suspension. And the chart I provided shows the results of a Florida study that looked at 182,000 students. Finally, another purpose of this bill is to try to reduce disparities in higher discipline rates among certain protected classes of students, students of color, students in from poor neighborhoods, from poor families, single-parent families, and students with disabilities. This chart shows that students with disabilities who actually have additional protections under federal law are disproportionately subject to suspension in Oregon. You often don't see us in this committee because we often focus on juvenile justice and child welfare issues, but we consider this a critical issue not only for those children and youth, but for all students in Oregon. There's been a disturbing trend identified over the past decade or so called the school-to-prison pipeline. So when students are put out of school and lacking that structure and supervision, they are much more likely to come in contact with the juvenile justice system. The Oregon Youth Authority found that there were only 15% of youth referred to the Oregon Youth Authority who had never been suspended or expelled from school, and 44% had been suspended or expelled four or more times. So if suspension and expulsion worked to improve behavior, we would not see that picture. We would see much the opposite, that students who had been subject to that discipline should be less likely to end up in the juvenile or criminal justice system, not more likely. So I'm happy to answer any questions, but I will let you review the rest of my written testimony as you wish. I also wanted to point out that Brian Meegert from the Springfield School District could not be here today to testify in person, but you also have his written testimony for your reference. Springfield has used evidence-based practices called positive behavioral interventions and supports for many years, and are finding that they're dramatically improving school safety, the school environment, and student behavior. And that is the kind of climate that this bill is intended to promote. Thank you.
Why don't you folks go too, and then we'll save our questions.
Thank you, Chair Haas. Committee members, good afternoon. My name is Martha Brooks, and I'm the State Director for Fight Crime, Invest in Kids, which is a bipartisan, non a bipartisan nonprofit anti-crime organization comprised of over 160 police chiefs, sheriffs, prosecutors, and victims of violence from around Oregon. We're also nationally almost 5,500 members. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of Fight Crime Investing Kids and on HB 2192. You may be wondering why law enforcement leaders are interested in the issue of school climate. Our members from across the state as well as the nation are concerned about the large number of students dropping out of school, and we know that unnecessary punitive expulsionary school discipline policies contribute to students' disengagement from school and failing to graduate, which quite frankly puts them in line, as Mark said, in the sights of my law enforcement members. Schools are suspending and expelling students more than ever before. As you can see in our report, which you should have also a hard copy as well as on your computers, Classmates, Not Cellmates, Oregon schools issued over 88,000 suspensions during 2011 and 2012. That's approximately half out of school, half in school. To put that number into perspective, last year Oregon expelled approximately the number of students it would take to fill 44 of our largest high schools with an average student population of 2,000 students. Over half of these suspensions were nonviolent and non-drug-related incidences. And as a parent of someone who graduated from Aloha High School, I can tell you that this number is disturbing to me, that when I went to school to be expelled or suspended, you had to do something pretty egregious. And it feels like there are a lot of kids who are maybe not doing very well, having some issues, who maybe need some conversation with a counselor, and they're getting kicked out, put on the streets, and then they're more likely to come into contact with the law enforcement. It is concerning for me as a parent. While it is imperative to keep weapons and violence out of our schools, over-reliance on harsh discipline policies, especially in cases where student conduct does not pose a safety threat, can be counterproductive when struggling students are removed from educational opportunities, making them more likely to drop out and eventually turn to crime. And Mark already gave you the statistics here in Oregon. When students are suspended for minor discipline issues for using inappropriate language or for other behavior that is distracting or disruptive but falls short of a safety threat, we need to figure out how best to address the root problem behind student misconduct without interrupting students' educational progress. Consider these findings. Students who are arrested in school are 2 times more likely to drop out of school. Students who are sent to court because of an in-school arrest are 4 times more likely to drop out. Students who are suspended 3 or more times by their sophomore year are 5 times more likely to drop out. And when a student drops out, he or she becomes 8 times more likely to end up in jail or prison than his or her peers who stayed in school. According to the U.S. Department of Education, Oregon has the 4th worst high school graduation rate in the nation, graduating just 68% of our kids from high school in 2011 in 4 years. With Oregon's current dropout crisis, we face a serious public safety concern. This is why it is clear to Fight Crime Investing Kids members that we must address school suspension and expulsion rules, make them more consistent, not only across the state, but within individual school districts, and end what is called the school-to-prison pipeline. For starters, it is important to reframe how we think about discipline. Rather than being a punishment as a consequence to behavior, an effective cultural and positive discipline comes through an upstream solution. Everyone in this room knows that when children act out, there are often multiple underlying causes, not just one. That is why the best approach is a collaborative, multidisciplinary, multi-agency approach. Schools, police officers, social workers, courts, families, and the community working together and share information on the students' needs to get the best outcomes for our kids. Law enforcement has long supported a balanced strategy to keep our streets safe. Prevention, intervention, and enforcement all have value. Public safety largely depends on kids getting a quality education in the classroom instead of on the streets. Interventions and non-punitive forms of addressing school discipline are essential to the strategy and especially effective because they help young people learn from their mistakes and develop the skills they need so that they have every opportunity to be successful in life. On behalf of law enforcement leaders across this state, we encourage and ask you to support and pass HB 2192 in order to keep kids in school and prevent crime. Thank you.
Thank you, Martha.
Senator Haas, members of the Senate, my name is Marian Chikarnas, and I'm the parent of a daughter in the Forest Grove School District. I'm in support of House Bill 2192 because I feel that our current zero tolerance policy is not only damaging to students, but is a contributing factor to the negative environment in our schools. My daughter was expelled towards the end of sixth grade for possession of a pocket knife. She was riding on the bus, and there were two boys that were bullying her behind her. They were playing with her hair and her neck and calling her names. And she repeatedly told them to stop, and she turned around and scratched them with her fingernails. And then she got off the bus, and they went up to the bus driver after she got off and said that she had a pocket knife, which they'd seen before because she has this nifty little scissor on her pocket knife right here. So the next day after lunch, she was called down to the office, and she was asked to empty her backpack and her pockets, and of course her little pocket knife was in her backpack because that's a safe place to keep it, or in her mind it was. And they explained to me that she would be expelled for 1 year because it was a mandatory 1 year expulsion per Oregon state law. And so I felt that reason would prevail at some point in this whole process, and I was wrong. And they marked her as expelled for the year. We appealed it to the superintendent, who agreed that on all the recommendations that she was not a risk to other students. She had always carried an AB grade average. She contributed to the community. She was a well-adjusted child with lots of friends and had never had any disciplinary issues before or since.
What school was this?
The Forest Grove School District, Tom McCall. The superintendent agreed and said she could attend school under guest status. There would be no restrictions in the district. So she was happy that she could go to school, do track, do all her normal activities. What I didn't realize after that, when the fall started and she started back to school, and even, you know, over the summer, it changed how she saw herself. She didn't always see herself as a child that was able to make good decisions. She questioned her ability to make good decisions. She started not trusting what adults said to her. She kind of withdrew somewhat. I could not believe how it changed her, how she saw herself as a person. Her self-confidence had withered. So that was very concerning. When she started in the fall, her grades had dropped significantly. And my husband and I, you know, she's a pretty well-adjusted child otherwise, and we worked with her to help get her grades up and try to restore her self-confidence and things like that. But I often think about the children that might not have that family support in their families, and how that's a life-changing event, something like that. So she has somewhat recovered, but I know that... This is a bad, you know, the zero tolerance policies need to be changed so that children and their past history needs to be looked at. They need to be assessed whether they're a danger or not to the school. Not one administrator or teacher in her case said that they felt she was any risk, but yet this remains on her record. So I really urge you to pass House Bill 2192. School policies need to change, and I don't believe that they will be willing to change those policies unless it's mandated by the state. So our personal experience is turning out okay. I wasn't sure that it would, you know, a year ago, but it is getting better. But it could have been extremely bad if she didn't have two parents who were very supportive and tried to restore her self-confidence. Thank you.
Thank you. Best of luck to you and her.
Thank you.
Question, were there consequences for the bullies?
I don't know, because the school told me it was confidential. Of course, my daughter is friends with some kids at school, so they said they were at school, so I don't know what happened. I can't say. So, but I know that they were at school, so, and they still are.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that knife you were holding up, according to TSA, that is a very dangerous weapon. So there are... I had one of those confiscated at the airport.
They let you know. They changed.
When?
Recently. Very recently.
2 months ago.
Yeah, 2 months ago.
You know, it's just a hard place to know where to draw the line, where to put in discretion on this subject, and I really appreciate your testimony. Did you have, Chris?
Yeah, mostly a statement. I mean, I absolutely... It's like so many other things we have done in our state. We have taken the discretion away from the people who are best trained to make those discretionary calls, and I get frustrated by that. As a principal, we had a few instances and guns on campus, and we have hunters in our school, and we would just call the parents and say, "I think your kid went, or parents went hunting this weekend. I think you want him to come home." And they'd call and they'd say, "Oh, yeah, we need to have him come home." And they'd say, "Yep," and they'd come back, and the rifle wouldn't be in the back of the window. I mean, as a kid growing up, they were always there. And then you put these no-tolerance deals in, and you're going to expel someone because the parent and the child were out having a hunting trip on the weekend, and he got the dad's truck to take to school and didn't notice it because it just wasn't noticeable. I don't think it makes any sense. And we're here to try to educate kids, and we educate them in lots of things that we do. And the thing that I've been the most frustrated with as a principal was that the government keeps asking schools to do more and more. We immunize, we do all these different kinds of things that take away from the mission, which is just to educate children. And that when we do that, we start forgetting some of the common sense things about how to work with these kids. My wife's an elementary principal, and the same thing. And I agree, you don't want dangerous people doing dangerous things. But if you really believe they were dangerous, when you let them out, they're going to be dangerous all day long. When you have people there,
that's a good point.
Without any supervision at all. So I mean, it's kind of like, come on. As a society, we need to realize that there's ways in which we can deal with this. And you know, we don't want bullying. We don't want those other activities. We need to keep always vigilant on that. But there are ways, and there are things you can do, and to manage people. And there are people, principals, teachers, and others who have been trained to deal with these kinds of things. And when we have zero tolerance things, we take it out of everybody's hands. And I'm happy with the superintendents and others that I've worked with who didn't necessarily would understand if you knew full well. And there were never any incidents afterwards. I mean, these kids came back and were good students, and no one had a problem. We've had battles with different people who felt we should do more and less and whatever, but the proof was in the fact that these kids didn't cause any harm and they weren't hurting anybody. So I'm sorry that your daughter had to go through it. I'm happy that the school let her come to school, but...
But it still remains on her record and will forever.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, well, we make a lot more of it than it really is.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll just tell you.
But, yeah.
Especially when we're in school, we like to think that we're the most important. But really what she does in the future and how she behaves in other people, that's going to be the first thing they look at. They're not going to.
Yeah.
And when she shows them her pocket knife out of her backpack when she's 20 and says, "This is the knife," they'll laugh and go on with it, so it'll be fine. But, I mean, it is a real serious issue. And suspensions, how we figure out how to not do them as much, because I don't know anybody in school that really wants to send kids in that route. And the evidence is pretty clear, so I appreciate your work here and being here today.
Mark, let me ask you, there's quite a bit in Section 5 dealing with firearms here.
Yep.
Can you give us a summary on what you're asking these districts, or what this bill would require these districts to do with respect to firearms and expulsion?
Sure, Senator Haas, I can answer that question very easily, is that we want them to do exactly the same as they're doing now, because the federal law is not being changed by this bill, and it's federal law that addresses that area.
Okay. Yep.
Mr. Chair, I do find it interesting. Everywhere else, it's kind of, I mean, you've got to set the policies, but it allows for discretion, except in that one instance. And it still allows for discretion case by case, but, you know, and the instances like Senator Roblin was talking about, it's kind of forcing them to go through some stuff that they may not necessarily have to, you know, as far as process, if, you know, it's just an honest mistake, but it's on school ground and this is it. So that's a bit troubling.
Yes. I didn't hear a question, Senator Cruz, but I'll just add that, yes, really, I think that unfortunately, administrators have felt that their hands are tied, and often even more than the law requires, because it's so poorly written and vague and open to interpretation. This, there is no definition in statute that says this is a dangerous or deadly weapon unless somebody is really trying to hurt somebody with it at the time. So actually, in this case, I think the expulsion, unfortunately, should never have happened. Mm-hmm. Certainly should not have been mandatory, but administrators are interpreting the current statute to require expulsion for items like this, or even less weapon-like items like fingers and other things like that.
So. And by the way, just for clarity, mine was a Leatherman, so it's probably a little more dangerous.
Okay, all right.
Senator Roper.
We used to have a fairly clearer definition 30 years ago or so. A switchblade was a dangerous weapon.
Mm-hmm.
A knife over 3 or 5, I think maybe it was 4 inches, 5 inches, I can't remember. There was a length to this determination before it became that. And the police had the same definition, and we would talk about that at schools about. But in reality, it was always about what their use was. The fact that the person had his little knife on his in his Leatherman in his pouch on the side and wasn't using it for any reason, no one thought that was a deadly weapon. So,
can I say one thing? I think most classrooms also have scissors and pencils, and those are awfully dangerous if used in the wrong manner. So,
well, I would just say in the last two sessions, this committee has worked to remove requirements and mandates on schools for cost reasons, flexibility reasons. So this really does add a fairly significant requirement to school districts to follow these rules, and I'm supportive. I'm just saying we're turning that corner here, or veering off the road a little bit here. So I guess I would just make that comment. Your story is probably Exhibit A. And it's a very compelling story. I know it's not the only one out there.
I wish I didn't have that story, but yeah.
Mr. Chair, I'd submit that what we have is so vague that it's being totally misinterpreted, and people are getting hit for absolutely innocent things. So when that happens, maybe it is time to step in and put some more definition.
But it does reinforce the notion that Senator Roblin mentioned, that we're asking these schools and these teachers to do a lot these days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Senator Hassan,
police.
I could comment on that. I believe we are asking our schools to step in and do this, but right now we're asking them to interpret, and interpretation is ending up in some expulsions that shouldn't happen, and so direction is okay, in fact asked for, obviously, by testimony from school districts. And I have a chief of police, I won't tell you where he's at because he's asked me not to, but his daughter went to school with a pocket knife about that size. They'd been out camping, and she forgot about it, left it in her backpack. She was digging around to get one of those dangerous pencils and found it. And she deep-sixed it in her backpack all day because she knew if that even saw the light of day. And it was a forgetful thing. Mm-hmm. And yet she would have been expelled. And she's straight-A student. Mm-hmm. So I have a police chief that says, you know, it's not a good thing.
And, you know, as a kid growing up, you will never find me without a pocket knife. I mean, my dad trained me. I mean, grew up in the community, you always had a pocket knife. And someone asked, could someone cut this rope? Could someone do this? It was part of who you are. So I've never understood some of this stuff. It's just,
I took you for a switchblade guy.
Never had. I may have had one. I have to go back and think about
Senator,
that.
Nope.
I'd just like to respond to Senator Roblin at Canope Preparatory Academy.
No knives?
All the children have knives.
Okay, there you go.
Well, except the five-year-old. She hasn't quite, you know, she's not there yet.
About right at the age. Yeah.
But the administration of that school is very open in this regard.
Okay, yeah. That's good to know.
All right.
I'm feeling better about that school all the time.
Thank you very much for your work on this. Representative Frederick, are you here on this bill?
No.
Okay, I'm sorry. Just want to make sure. Morgan Allen from the School Boards Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Morgan Allen from OSBA here in support of House Bill 2192. We are part of the work group with other education folks. OEA, COSA were included in the development of this bill, and just wanted to add our voice. We agree with a lot of the points that have already been made. This is a good first step to bring discipline into the 21st century. Probably much to the chagrin of my father, but the bill sort of strikes the right balance between appropriate discipline and the health and safety of other students. It respects local control. It puts discretion in the hands of teachers and administrators and boards, and that's important. There's, as was mentioned, there's compelling data that the positive behavior supports and response to intervention type programs, which in fact the majority of school districts in Oregon have, are in the process of implementing, work better than sort of the old school Papa Allen type of discipline. But I think there's three things just that are really important is that zero tolerance for the weapons. That's been really problematic, and it's a real challenging area for our schools and our districts and how they've been interpreted that, and that's been discussed quite a bit. So I want to make it clear, though, unfortunately, it doesn't get rid of the, because there's a federal definition for firearms that we cannot get rid of, so this will only deal with non-firearm weapons. So unfortunately, the example of Representative Roblin's student, you know, having the hunting rifle in the truck would still be a mandatory expulsion, but we can take care of the other things when students have pocket knives, so that's important. The bill also limits expulsion to the most serious offenses or when there's a repeated pattern of problematic behavior by students. Right now, theoretically or technically under the statute, you could expel a student for chewing gum or the first time they got to detention. Now, people don't do that, but we want to make sure that that's clear, that suspension is sort of a option of last resort for schools, and you've heard all the reasons why it is problematic for students who get suspended and expelled. And I think the last thing, and the reason I'm up here, is because it talks about school board policy. And under this bill, school boards would be required to sort of, again, modernize their policies, sort of use that response to intervention, positive behavior support type language in their discipline policies. Consider important things like age or, you know, past behavior of the student when meting out discipline. So for all those reasons, we're very supportive of the bill, and we would urge you to pass it.
Thank you, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, so Morgan, one of the things you said there, so you're saying that allowing teachers and administrators the discretion to do the job they were trained to do is maybe a good thing?
Okay. Senator, that's correct.
Senator Roblin?
Yeah, just a question. We always felt at our school, I thought it was the state law, and I wondered if it's the same, that even if you're expelling a student, you had an obligation to go over alternative lists with
That's
them
correct.
About other kinds of ways they could get their education while they were being expelled, whether that was be an online school or the Canope school or alternative school or whatever.
So that's an excellent point, Senator Roblin. Right now, if a student is suspended, there's an obligation for the school district to offer alternative forms of education, and that's for suspensions for weapons and firearms. That's mandatory. And one of the extra benefits of removing the zero tolerance for weapons is I think it would probably provide some more opportunities for students to have those in-school opportunities and alternative programs. I mean, the whole idea behind this, I think, and sorry if this is repetitive, but one of the underlying ideas is that we want to keep kids engaged in the school, and just sort of turning them out onto the streets is not beneficial, as you know, and keeping them involved, keeping them up on their schoolwork, keeping them in the school building, even if it's in a separate room or things like that, are all things that are proven to improve discipline and help academics and turn kids around. But that requirement would still be there for the firearms, is my understanding, the alternative education.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.
All righty. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2192. We have a technical amendment that doesn't have its paperwork here with us yet today, and we'll take it up next week.
Okay.
And let me open up a public hearing on House Bill 2665. Richard, if you could give us a summary.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2665 directs the Department of Education to conduct an evaluation of means by which the impact of poverty on educational attainment is addressed. It requires the department to submit a report to the interim legislative committees no later than 1st of July 2014, and it declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Chair Haas and members of the committee. I'm Representative Lou Frederick, House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I bring you House Bill 2665. This is about the impact of poverty on educational attainment and how it is or is not being addressed in state law. Now, we know that poverty is a handicapping factor in educational attainment. We know this. It has been well documented over and over. But I do not believe there's a coordinated program to mitigate the impact of poverty on educational attainment. House Bill 2665 directs the Department of Education to conduct an evaluation of the means by which the impact of poverty on educational attainment is addressed in state law and to submit a report to interim legislative committees. So, it's one of those study bills. I wish we were ready for some kind of comprehensive approach to giving children living in poverty, living with poverty, the opportunity, the access, and the resources it takes to lower the barriers to their success. And I feel that the next step at this time is a comprehensive catalog of the ways that we as a state try to address these special needs and the way that we as a state come up short on this. Now, I would be the last one to say that children living in poverty cannot succeed. Stories about people who have triumphed over the conditions of their childhood abound. They're part of our American story canon, part of my family's canon. But the challenges are real. For every outstanding student who makes it despite such challenges, there are many others who are defeated by them. And frankly, legions of mediocre students who do just fine because they don't have to face such barriers. I'm also not saying that their challenges come from them. At-risk children is a terrible way to talk about kids. All children are at risk. Every parent knows that fact inside and out. But some are born into riskier environments than others. Some live in environments that become riskier as they grow up, and for reasons they do not create. Every child needs stimulating, interesting things to do and learn every day. It's Dr. Donna Beagle, who gave an outstanding presentation on the subject to the House Education Committee, describes so well. The time and energy focused on family survival crowds out a lot of the joy of life that many of us are fortunate to take for granted, including the stimulating experiences that keep a kid going and growing. As a friend of mine once put it, poverty is really boring. It is boring because it is relentless, the same challenges over and over again. And that is really hard on children, boredom. Boredom for children is risky. Families that have the means and families that in which the parents have the experiential context of a stimulating upbringing themselves make sure that their children have the experiences and the support to keep going and to keep growing. Depriving a child's mind of that stimulation and support is like depriving a plant of water, light, or fertilizer. Sure, some of them overcome that, and that makes for some great stories, but many do not. And the question we should ask ourselves is, why should they have to? This bill just asks that we take the preliminary step of finding out how poverty and the barriers it creates to educational attainment are already addressed in Oregon law. We have seen in the past a periodic proliferation of programs, and sometimes, frankly, they step on each other. The goal here is to compile the information we need to develop a well-coordinated plan to improve them. This bill has a minimal fiscal impact, and a referral to the Ways and Means was rescinded in the House. I hope for a positive fiscal impact in the form of the ability to better focus our efforts to address this very real obstacle, and I urge you to pass it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. I think I do agree with your general concept that helping education is the great equalizer and helps ultimately save society. And let me ask you a devil's advocate. What question you said about coordination I think is really important. In the school district I'm from, the Title I schools, federal money for poverty,
mm-hmm.
tend to do better funding-wise than the schools that are not Title I, where there's a more middle-class population mix. And so while I appreciate the need to do more, better coordinated help, do you do not see that as one place where we're trying to equalize things?
Oh, thank you, Senator Haas. I think that is one place that we're trying. My point is that we don't know across the state. I know the Portland schools rather well, until I left about 6 years ago. The fact is that we can see real differences between programs in the same economic group. So the schools are often the same official status in terms of their poverty status, but they have different approaches that are being successful and some that are not. That's what I want to see. That's what I think we need to find out. What's working and what's not working? We don't have that right now. The Title I schools, you know, get additional funds. That often means additional staff, and those staff tend to then be able to work with kids a little better, rather than having to worry about other things. We know some things that do work. One-on-one situations or smaller number of contacts for adults with children works, and we just need to figure out what it is that really does work.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Representative. I'm going to use a word I hate to use, and that word is task force. And
I understand.
Okay. And the reason I bring that up is oftentimes when you're dealing with an agency, in this case Department of Ed, and I've been involved in several, let's call it a work group, it's a softer word, okay. where we have tasked them with this sort of work, but we have also had make sure all interested parties, including legislators, are part of the process. Sometimes you can get better results. Did you give that any thought in doing this, or?
I did give it some thought, okay. but because of the way that people respond to task force and work groups, I think the study is what we need right now. From the department does have some information,
right?
So let's gather that information together by way of the department, rather than trying to put together a larger group. I think we will begin to really work with this in a much stronger fashion by the time we get a report back from them.
I might. Okay, and Mr. Thank you. I'll accept that. The one change I might have considered would be to require a report during legislative days on interim steps. My fear, quite honestly, is we get to the end of this thing, and you know, how do we have the chance to digest or looking at what they have done to a date certain and say, no, you need to be going over there. You see what I'm saying?
I do indeed see what you're saying. Well, let's, I'm trying to get the first step here.
No,
and that's, yeah. That's what I'm trying to work with, is just getting the first step in.
Senator Rubin?
Yeah, and I want to thank you because it's one of the first times I've seen a study that isn't just about the school. When you look at the questions about getting money for extra money for these schools, most of their time is not spent at school.
Mm-hmm.
They're there for 6 hours, and they've got 18 hours of other time, and that's the time when poverty takes its biggest toll out of kids. And at least in your study, you're talking about what are the kinds of things in the neighborhood, what are the kinds of things in the house, what are the things. Many of these parents don't know what to do to help their children, and we need parent programs that make sure that they can find a place where the person can study and support to doing some studying. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we know works with these kids if people around them start to do it. A book at the house, you know, a newspaper. And so this study is more about, from my perspective, it's more about the education, looking at places that are working. You know, we have schools that are, their kids seem to be, as a larger group, doing better. And so what can we learn from those in and out of the school? Because, you know, we do after-school programs, but again, those only usually a couple hours extra. It's the rest of their life that creates the stuff. And I think what this bill does in studying it is saying, please look at that, see what the communities have, what we can develop. Because I think schools can't do it all, but they can certainly support the doing of it in other ways. So I appreciate the idea of the bill.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Haasen, Senator Roblin. I agree, and in my time, I've seen several things that actually work. One of the simplest things for getting kids to school was to discover that one of the reasons that they weren't getting to school was sometimes because they were taking care of younger siblings. But the most effective thing in the Portland schools they discovered was about a $5 alarm clock. Yeah. Because folks were just not getting up and ready. Once they got the alarm clock, the kids were getting to school. It was that simple. But on a more basic level, it was sometimes just that the kids were hungry, that there was not enough food in the house, that they were coming home to, and we have tried to address that in a number of ways, but not in all places. And across the state, it's not an urban rural thing. I mean, you've got poverty everywhere, and we really do now. It's really clear. So it's a matter of figuring out what works across the state. Everything that you do in Madras is not going to be necessarily the same thing you want to do in Coos Bay, but you are getting a chance to see what's working there, and that's what I want to see.
Urban, rural, suburban.
Suburban.
There
Sorry.
We go.
Yes, poverty, it's very poverty. Very clear.
Poverty and suburbia.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Beaverton School District has 1,500 students classified as homeless.
Yeah.
If I may, Senator Haas, one of the things that that we won't be able to do this, but the Finnish response to that was one of my favorite ones. One of my friends was over in Finland on Fulbright, and she was talking about the fact to the Finnish education head and said, well, now, what do? We have kids who come to school. They haven't gotten a chance to do their homework. They haven't had any food. They have no bath. They've been sleeping in the car. They're homeless. What do you do for homeless kids here in Finland? And the Finnish education person said, we give them homes. it seemed like a pretty straightforward concept.
Yeah.
You know, 1,500, I don't know what the numbers are in Portland. They are huge. But you also have those same homeless kids in SIO, and you may have those same homeless kids down along the coast. And I mean, we have that taking place. They may be couch surfing, but they don't have a home that they can really go home to. So.
Just one more thing, Mr. Chair. I support the bill, and I would suggest if you have a conversation with Chair Gelser without putting it in the bill, she can request interim updates on the progress during legislative days. If she makes that request, they can come and do it. So put that on her radar screen, and then we won't have to put it in the bill. So.
Good deal. Okay. Thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Rip. Better. We'll close the hearing on House Bill 2665.
I agree with you.
I mean, if you just say, okay, bring us something by a date certain, you don't know what the hell they're going to do.
Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2995. Richard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2995 requires each public university, community college, or other institution of higher education to allow students, faculty, and staff to identify sexual orientation on forms used to collect demographic data.
Okay. Let's our panel. These guys. Let's call up Stephen Leader, C.M. Hall, and Emma Calloway. If you wouldn't mind coming up together.
That's strange. Isn't it? Well, C.M.
Good to see you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Do you want to go first? How about if I go first?
Okay.
Is it just us? Okay.
Go ahead.
Greetings, gentlemen. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2995. My name is C.M. Hall, and I coordinate the Western Region Interpreter Education Center that's housed at Western Oregon University. It's a federal grant, and I also teach at the university in the Sociology Department, Political Science Department, and Sign Language Interpreting Program. I specifically teach in the Sociology and Political Science Department a course for lesbian, gay, bi, trans, and queer studies. And I work with our student organization, Triangle Alliance. I'm also a member of the board of Basic Rights Oregon. I'm a proud Native Oregonian. As you may know, Basic Rights Oregon is our state's leading advocacy organization for gay and transgender communities. We represent tens of thousands of Oregonians from every corner of this state. And we are strongly urging passage of this House bill. House Bill 2995 is a simple bill, and I would like to take a moment to explain a little bit more about it. It would require public universities and colleges to add sexual orientation to the list of routine demographic data collected that is already existing forms. It allows universities and colleges to update their forms at the time of reprinting to avoid incurring additional costs for new forms. And like any other demographic information, it is optional for anyone filling out the form to participate by disclosing information regarding their status. This is a modest but important proposal to collect important information to address disparities. According to Too Afraid to Learn, a 2008 survey of over 3,500 Oregon college students, a hostile campus climate has a significant impact on gay and transgender students and their efficacy. 1 in 10 gay and transgender students took more than 5 years to graduate due to anti-LGBT sentiment. Over half of gay and transgender students concealed their sexual orientation on campus for fear of personal safety, discrimination, or rejection. And more than 60% of all students reported that witnessing instances of homophobia, biphobia, transphobia, in terms of language or violence were incidents that they experienced. As a member of our university staff, data collection does matter to me both personally and professionally. And I want all students to get the support that they need to thrive at Western, but in all of our public universities and colleges. Faculty and staff strive to provide this support individually, and collecting data on these experiences of students, faculty, and staff would help our institutional practices catch up to our individual practices. Clear, consistent data collection would allow Oregon colleges and universities to accurately assess and appropriately address the experiences of gay and transgender students, faculty, and staff. This House bill would allow students, faculty, and staff to identify their sexual orientation on forms collecting the demographic information without mandating collection. House Bill 2995 allows colleges and universities to replicate successes and address disparities, and that strengthens Oregon colleges for all of our students. As a representative of Basic Rights Oregon, we are urging passage of House Bill 2995, and we ask you to move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Stephen Leiter, and I am here today to testify in support of House Bill 2995 regarding gathering demographic data concerning sexual orientation in higher education. Presently, I'm a graduate student at Oregon State University in the Master's in Interdisciplinary Studies program. My three areas of study focus on women's studies, ethnic studies, and adult higher education. My research focuses on the experiences of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer students seeking to replace lost familial funding after being dispossessed by parents following the student's coming out, which is either self-disclosing their sexual orientation or gender identity, or being outed, which is someone other than the student revealing their sexual identity to their family. For 6 years prior to beginning my graduate studies, I was professional faculty at Oregon State University as Director of LGBT Outreach and Services within the Office of Intercultural Student Services. For 8 years prior to coming to Corvallis, I worked at UCLA's LGBT Campus Resource Center as a student affairs officer. Altogether, I've worked in the field of student affairs in American higher education for 15 years. I propose to my representative, Sarah Gelser, that she sponsor the legislation that ultimately became House Bill 2995 because, as a result of my graduate research and my work as a student affairs professional, I came to realize there is virtually no demographic data anywhere in higher education literature about LGBTQ college students. In contrast, we have large bodies of knowledge on many other student populations, including Black, African American, Latina, Latino, Asian Pacific Islander, Native American, Indian, women, parent, graduate, commuter, veteran, older than average, non-traditional, community college, athlete, engaged, disengaged, low socioeconomic status, privileged, gifted, profoundly gifted, mental health challenged, disabled, or differently abled, first generation, returning, transfer, reverse transfer, international, rural, urban, suburban, remedial, and other college students. These bodies of knowledge grow larger by the day. This is not the case with our body of knowledge about LGBTQ college students. This dearth of demographic data severely hinders any kind of empirical research from being conducted about this largely invisible student population. Consequently, we have no idea how successful our efforts at recruitment and retention of LGBTQ college students are, nor do we in the Oregon higher education community have any idea about the graduation or dropout rates of LGBTQ college students within the state. These are the most basic evaluative units by which success or failure of access and equity judgments are made in our education systems. And yet, we can't provide answers to these simple and most basic questions about admission and completion rates. At a time when we in higher education are being asked to justify our budgets and prove the success of our education programs, this is an important shortcoming within the system, one that is overcome by passage of this simple piece of legislation. It enables us to gather data that will help us to evaluate and assess the success or failure of our current programming efforts on behalf of one of the state's most underserved and invisible college student populations. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. Again, I urge your support of HB 2995.
Thank you. I'll just make this comment. 20 years ago, if this language showed up in a bill, it would probably be from groups that were hostile to the gay rights movement, and there'd be a hue and outcry. And it's just interesting how things have changed, evolved. I must ask you, though, if it only allows students to identify this way, then how is it useful as a research tool?
Well, at present, we haven't any idea how many of our students might identify as LGBT or queer. Elmhurst College in Illinois, about 18 months ago, began asking this question of their incoming first-year students. Elmhurst is a small, private, four-year college, religiously affiliated. Astonishingly, they got between 85 and 90% response rates from students, which is unheard of, to have that kind of a response rate on this particular question. And they were surprised to find out that about 5% of their student population identified as lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or queer, which is at the top end of current estimates about what the general population of LGBT people in the larger population might be. So we know that students begin the coming out process in their early teens, and that will go through all the way until after they've graduated from college. But most of those individuals will begin that process prior to arriving on the doorstep at their university or college. So we'll never have a full picture, but right now we have no picture at all. So it's an important first step.
Questions from these two witnesses on House Bill 2995? Okay. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I want to temporarily close the public hearing on House Bill 2995 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2958 because Representative Comp is here. And I know that she's sponsoring this bill, and if you could give us a quick summary while she comes to the dais.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2958A requires community colleges to make specified information available for distribution to public school students in grades 11 and 12 annually. It requires representatives of the State Board of Education and Higher Education Coordinating Commission to meet regularly for the purposes of improving coordination between public secondary schools and community colleges. It declares an emergency effective 1st of July, 2013.
Okay, thank you, Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair Haas and committee members. This bill has a little bit of history, and the history, part of it comes from our your good chair. It passed a bill last session that said we're going to have all students graduate from high school, 20% get just that diploma, which is an important step in everybody's life, 40% are going to get an associate's degree, and 40% are going to get a bachelor's degree. Well, in our siloed system, which I think all of you are very well aware of, some information is not conveyed between particularly community colleges and high schools. We have had several bills this session that talk about dual credit for a number of things, whether you're in an AP program, international baccalaureate, or just taking community college credit. In fact, we had one bill that was suggesting that we need to require 9 credits of community college level work in order to graduate. That is the purpose behind this bill. We need to have a communication between K-12 and our higher ed colleagues so that there is much more information available to our students, our counselors, and our parents. A number of years ago, we passed legislation that every 10th grader take either the ACT or the PSAT so that they had an understanding along with their parents, and maybe some of them hopefully surprised at how well they did on those assessments, to get them to thinking about their viability as somebody that would go on to higher education. All this bill does is to say, you are going to meet with people in the K-12 system, whether we have not finished the passage of some of our higher education bills as yet, such as Senate Bill 270 and some of these others, with the HEC and with looking at the coordination through the Department of Education and the OEIB. And I can't believe I'm just using all those acronyms, because I usually just hate those. But this is to help foster that communication and to make sure that all of our students have the appropriate information to make good decisions. I ask for your support and want to thank you for your time. I know everybody's busy here. We're getting a little closer to the end each day.
I wish that were true.
Senator Cruz and Representative Kahn, can you identify yourself for the record?
Oh, thank you. I totally missed that. Chair Haas and committee, I'm Betty Kopp. I serve House District 22, Woodburn, Jervis, Brooks, and Northeast Salem.
Senator Cruz?
Why the no votes?
Some people felt that this is already being done. That it's a step that should be so common sense that we shouldn't need it. That's what was shared with me. And it is a lot of common sense, but we know we've all worked together long enough to know that sometimes
common sense and government don't travel in the same.
Not necessarily. We try, but not necessarily.
Thank you, Chair Haas. Did the community colleges testify in support of the bill?
Chair Haas and Senator I don't remember. Committee would have to ask our previous committee staff. I really don't remember.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure that the community colleges are able to do this without adding to essentially we're requiring them to do something. I stopped short of calling it a mandate only because you changed the language, I think, in the it looks like in the amendment that you made, to make available instead of distribute, right?
That's correct.
And so what is the difference there to you? What does that mean?
The difference to me is, and I'm going to be aging myself, when I was administrator at a high school, you'd go into the counseling office and see university and community college manuals and class lists that were mailed to the school, and the students would have to go into the counseling office, and some of them never even ventured in that door, I don't think, to find out the resources. And make available is simply that they can make sure that, and I don't know how to do this with a computer program, but that they send out electronically their curriculum options, and so that the school districts can easily access them. And yeah, I'm thinking it's a pretty simple thing, because I know I'm going to go back to PSU here and finish a program that I haven't completed, and you just go to those websites, and that's how you get make available. We're not asking them to publish anything, send anything through the mail, make extra copies.
Senator Knoll?
Yeah, I don't know that I have any further questions. I'm just, I would just like to hear from the community colleges about how they would do this, what they would do.
Okay. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rep.
And I do appreciate the questions. I did not, and in all honesty, I did not have a communication with the community colleges personally to see how they would do this. It was maybe my assumption there, and I know what assumption means, that, yes, this could be easily done electronically, and they have this available for all community college students now, and we just are asking an additional step of it going to the K-12 system.
Yeah, I just, if we're going to do it, I just want to make sure that we're not just adding something for them to do, that it is actually effective and moving toward the 40-40-20 goal. I don't particularly want to put a mandate on them, but if we can find a way that they can embrace it and do it, and it's going to get us toward the goal, I could be supportive of that.
Yeah. Thank you for your time, committee. Appreciate your consideration.
Thank you.
Thank you. All righty. Closing the public hearing on House Bill 2958, opening the public hearing on House Bill 2995. We have a couple of other people. Dan Cushing and Dave Coburn.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, thank you for having us. My name is Dan Cushing. I'm the Vice President for the Associated Students of Oregon State University, and I self-identified bisexual man.
And my name is Kaya McConnell. I'm also from the Associated Students of Oregon State University. I'm the Director of Queer Affairs.
Kaya and I are here today from Oregon State to testify in support of HB 2995. I do not claim to speak on behalf of all LGBTQQIAA folks, or we can say queer for short. Rather, I do hope to represent my constituents at Oregon State who feel that it is high time for the formal recognition of our sizable and vibrant queer community. As you all may know, queer rights and social acceptance have improved dramatically in recent times, but there is work yet to be done. To borrow from the feminist movement, I will remind the committee that the personal is political. In other words, our identities have implications for our role in society and on our campuses, and the rights conferred or withheld from our communities shape our personal lives and success. Now, on our university campuses today in Oregon, openly queer folks face bullying, violence, and discrimination, among other hardships. Remaining in the closet can have detrimental impacts to a person's mental health, which is especially challenging for university students who are in need of full mental faculty for their classroom learning, career development, and often working part-time jobs to pay for school. Thus, despite recent successes in the legal and social realms, queer folks both in and out of the closet continue to be an oppressed group in our society. Now, in order to combat this oppression, which is affecting a vast number of our students in the state of Oregon, we need to better understand their struggle and provide resources when appropriate. And in order to do that, we need to know these people through demographic data collection. By allowing folks such as me to self-identify the way one identifies other aspects of his or her identity, we will empower our institutions to confront the issues facing the queer community in a conscious manner. As it has already been stated today, a self-identification measure for sexual orientation will not provide a wholly accurate accounting for our community, as many folks will likely identify straight for fear of reprisal. Nonetheless, it is a step in the right direction for our state. Personally, I feel that recognizing the queer community statistically through self-identification would have affirmed my value in the university community more, empowering me to become a successful scholar. For my constituents who are queer, as well as their friends, roommates, classmates, colleagues, students, sisters, brothers, daughters, sons, mothers, and fathers, queer folks, passage of this bill means moving Oregon forward as a pioneer of a more free and just society for us all. Therefore, I ask this committee to recognize the existence of queer communities on our college and university campuses and pass HB 2995 out of committee. Thank you so much for your time, and I'll be happy to take questions after.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas and members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to provide testimony today. For the record, my name is Dave Coburn, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon Student Association. I'm urging support for House Bill 2995. There is another student whose testimony I've brought with me today. I will not be reading it, but I will drop it off at the desk for those of you interested. Many people perceive Portland to be a place that's always friendly and open to LGBTQ people. As an openly gay student, this perception doesn't match my experience. While I am very open with my friends and colleagues on the Portland State campus, I've at times hidden my identity for my own physical safety. According to Too Afraid to Learn, a 2008 survey of over 3,500 Oregon college students, over half concealed their sexual orientation on campus for fear of personal safety, discrimination, or rejection. And so to kind of lay that out, that would mean that over half of Oregon's LGBT students don't feel safe on their campuses. And that's a real barrier to academic success. I concealed my identity entirely for these reasons until my junior year of college, and did not encounter important resources until midway through that year. Without standardized data collection, Oregon's colleges and universities won't be able to accurately assess and appropriately address the experiences of LGBT students, faculty, and staff. Not everyone wears a big neon sign explaining their sexuality to others. So it can be difficult to accurately assess the needs and experiences of students without making a concerted effort to hear from them, especially those students who choose to conceal their identity. Updating data collection forms on our campuses will allow students the option to self-identify and will equip campuses with important information to assess recruitment and retention rates more accurately without compromising their confidentiality. Passing this legislation is a non-intrusive way to begin to understand the needs and experiences of Oregon's LGBT students. Clear, consistent data collection helps ensure that Oregon's public higher education institutions have the tools they need to meet all students' needs. HB 2995 would allow students, faculty, and staff of public universities and colleges the option to identify their sexual orientation on forms collecting demographic information, collect consistent data to help replicate successes and address disparities, create the opportunity to collect data voluntarily, disclosure is not mandated, and this bill has received the support of the Oregon University System and is a small, common sense step towards assessing and breaking down disparities. Thank you for your time. I'm happy to take questions.
Questions? We have not heard from the university system on this bill in this committee or in the House.
Okay.
Well, we thank you for your work on this. Thank you for coming forward.
Thank you.
Okay, is there anyone else who hasn't testified and would like to on House Bill 2995? Then I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2995, and that clears our agenda for the day. No further business before us. We are adjourned.